We're continuing the study of harmonic oscillators and the way that they are driven. Remember that there are two basic mechanisms to increase the amplitude of oscillators, that is to excite them. And correspondingly, there are also two mechanisms that can excite the oscillators of quantum fields. So one mechanism is that there is a time-varying driving force on our harmonic oscillator, J of t. And the other mechanism is that some of the constants, one or several of the constants in the equation of motion of the harmonic oscillator or in the Hamiltonian, are made artificially time-dependent, such as the time-dependent mass, time-dependent length of a pendulum, or time-dependent D'Alembert operator in the case of an expanding space-time, or in the case of a collapsing star. Now, we are currently considering the case A, where harmonic oscillators get excited through an external time-varying driving force. So the mathematical machinery that we will study today will be very simple, just one harmonic oscillator. But it's a prototype calculation that applies all over the place. It applies to particle physics, for example, collisions of particles at CERN. It applies to the study of black holes and Hawking radiation. It applies to the study of cosmology when you apply this to mode oscillators of quantum fields. So the overall structure of the math that we'll do is representative of these things, as you will see later then. So we are considering the case A, harmonic oscillators that are externally driven for now. And remember, there we have a harmonic oscillator's Hamiltonian, which is of the usual form, 1/2 p squared, where for convenience we are choosing the unit such that the mass has a numerical value of 1. And then omega squared 1/2 q hat squared minus j q hat. This is the term that couples this external driving force to our harmonic oscillator. You may wonder about this term q hat, the elongation. When you calculate the equations of motion for this Hamiltonian, then that q hat term goes away, right? If you calculate the equation of motion for p hat dot, the right-hand side is the commutator of the Hamiltonian with p hat. And that picks up the J term in this case. In any case, it's clear that you couldn't just have a J here because that's commutative. And so it wouldn't affect the dynamics at all. Because commutator with the Hamiltonian wouldn't pick up that term. Let us assume that our Hamiltonian has a driving force which is non-zero only during a finite time interval. So we are saying that the J of t function is zero for all t outside that critical interval where stuff is happening. Things are happening from time zero to time capital T, but before that, no force is applied, and after that, no force is applied. This is a prototypical situation. For example, in particle physics, where you have accelerators accelerating particles, well, before they collide, they are independent harmonic oscillators that propagate freely. In the collisions, then, these harmonic oscillators drive each other. They constitute forces for each other. Each species of particle provides driving forces for other species of particles. And then after the collision is over, they again propagate away as free particles. And the mass of it basically boils down to a situation like this. It's actually similar for black holes. When you look at the case of a star collapsing, you can have a simple situation going in where you have a collapsing shell or something like that. Then all hell breaks loose and you have a supernova and eventually a black hole forms and then things settle down again. Again, in this case, you have a clean situation where things go in. You have a clean situation after everything has happened. And in the middle, we are not so, we would be interested in it, but we can't really calculate it. But in this case, things are simple enough that we can calculate through everything. But still, this overall structure that I want to present is how these calculations are done. When we have an ingoing situation that is simple, then all hell breaks loose. And then afterwards, there's again an outgoing situation that's simple. And then we calculate how the ingoing situation translates into the outgoing situation. How do we get the overall dynamics from the in states to the out states? And we will do this in the Heisenberg picture. This is, in principle, not any harder than the Schrödinger picture, but it requires a rethinking. Because now the dynamics is not in the states. The states are just describing initial conditions. All of the dynamics is in the operators. In order to solve the case of the driven harmonic oscillator, externally driven harmonic oscillator, we defined a convenient variable A of t. And this variable we defined to be a linear combination of both the position operator and the momentum operator. In the case of quantum fields, we will have for every mode a linear combination of the mode and its canonically conjugate mode. But for now, it's just a harmonic oscillator. Those coefficients, in principle, are arbitrary. We choose them real so that cleanly we get the q out of A by picking the Hermitian part, and cleanly we get the p hat out of A, if we want to, by just picking out the imaginary or the anti-Hermitian part. But then we chose these coefficients very wisely. We chose them in this particular way to fulfill two conditions, if you remember. We chose these coefficients in such a way that A and A dagger have the commutation relations A, A dagger commutator is 1, arising from the QP commutation relations. If we choose those prefactors cleverly, as we did. But secondly, you see, this fixed only one prefactor. Now we chose the other prefactor in such a way that the Hamiltonian, when expressed in terms of A and A dagger, takes a simple form. In principle, if you choose any prefactors here, your A and A daggers are going to be such that the Hamiltonian is going to contain not just A dagger A terms, but also A dagger squared and A squared terms. But with a clever choice of prefactors, we were able to arrange that the Hamiltonian took this very simple form. Okay, so remember, in principle, you're free to choose those, but you want the commutation relations to be simple and the Hamiltonian to be simple, and that fixes the two. But keep in mind, if you have a different harmonic oscillator, like a different omega, then, well, numerically, these values change with omega. Which means that for quantum fields, the relationship between the canonical variables and their conjugate, and their canonical conjugate, and the A and A dagger operators is going to depend on which mode you're considering. There's no universal relationship between them. So the Hamiltonian takes this form here. That would be the Hamiltonian without an external driving force, and this is the external driving force term. Remember, this is just the Q hat. I mean, 1 over square root of 2 omega times that is the Q hat. Now, instead of solving the dynamics, instead of solving the equations of motion for Q and P separately, we can write down the equations of motion for A of t, which contains the information of both of them at once. The equations of motion then become a single equation of motion, namely that I d by dt of A is equal to omega times A. And we know that if there was no force term, that would immediately tell us that A has to be an exponential, e to the minus I omega t. But there's going to be a force term in general. And so we have to solve this differential equation for given driving force that we choose. And we also have to make sure that the commutation relations hold for all times. Then we also gave a name to the A operator. Remember, this operator that knows everything about the Q and the P. At the initial time t equals 0. At the time t equals 0, we will call that operator A in for ingoing. So A in is simply a fixed operator. It is the value of A, an operator, at time t equals 0. Then we solve the problem. It's just a differential equation that we need to solve with the suitable initial condition. And that is claimed to be the solution. let's just check the initial condition. If t is equal to 0, this should be a in. Let's see. If t is equal to 0, then we have that this t makes that exponent 0, so we have a in. And here we have some number times 1, and then we have to integrate from 0 to 0. Therefore, no contribution from this stuff. Therefore, indeed, a of 0 is a in. But you also need to check the differential equation. Remember this one. This one, but it's not difficult to check. You just need to keep in mind, and that's something that you may not do every day, that when you calculate that time derivative of a, there's something non-trivial happening here. Namely, you have to calculate the time derivative of a, which you have to perform here. You have to perform it there, but also have to perform it here. All right? So all of this can be summarized as that. It's a in plus the identity operator times this number valued function here times e to the power of minus I omega t. We've just pulled a factor of e to the power of minus omega t outside the bracket here because it appeared here and there. Now remember that the force is acting only for a finite amount of time, which means that this integral keeps growing. I mean, for t equals 0, it's 0, but then it keeps growing. I mean, it takes on complex values. But then once t exceeds capital T, which is the last time that the force is acting, then this, the value of that integral no longer changes. The upper integration boundary still changes, but the integrand is 0. So the value of the integral doesn't change anymore. Let us give that value of the complete integral from 0 to capital T. Let us give that a name. And that's the value of J naught. It's a complex number. This complex number will be very important because it encodes everything that the force did to the harmonic oscillator, as you will see. So what do we have? The time evolution of A of T is given at early times for t before 0 by a in times e to the power minus I omega t. Because the differential equation is the differential equation without the force term. It's just derivative is proportional to the amplitude. So we know that that's the solution. On the other hand, if we are in the intermediate time period, while the force is acting between 0 and capital T, then the formula for a of t is what we wrote above. It's this whole thing. And then at late times, so when the time is later than capital T, so when the force has stopped acting, then a of t is given by a in plus j naught. Right? A of t is a in plus j naught. Because once little t is larger than capital T and the force has stopped acting, this is just a constant, j naught. Well, times e to the power of minus I omega t. So let us give this a name. This thing here, a in plus j naught, technically plus j naught times the identity operator, because this is an operator, that needs to be an operator too. That thing we call a out. Just an operator in Hilbert space. So it differs from a in just by the addition of a complex number times a constant, times the identity. All right. So now we do this trick that I talked about for particle collisions. Three particles come in, crash into each other at CERN, and then they fly apart again, and they are separate. The crash itself is super complicated. What we're looking at is probabilities for certain incoming particles to do something and then produce certain outgoing particles. So that's just the overall balance of the collision. And similarly, for a black hole, you have a collapse. Something complicated happens. At the end, you may have a black hole and possibly Hawking radiation. And also for an expanding space-time, you could imagine a situation, and that is a little artificial now, but we will make this thing realistic. You could imagine a space-time which is Minkowski space for a long time. And then for some reason, the space-time starts expanding. So it expands, 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 and then it turns into Minkowski space again, stops expanding. You could imagine such a space-time. Or a space-time that for a while shrinks and then becomes Minkowski space-time again. In that case, too, we would have an initial situation with operators A in and a final situation with operators A out, as we will see. Okay, so we claim we have a solution here. We have that A of t takes this form for early times with A in and then with A out for late times. This is just the same bracket that I wrote in the previous slide, except I skipped the middle term. We are no longer interested in the actual behavior while the force is acting, just the overall impact of what the force did. Where, if you remember, A out was A in plus J naught. Let's see. If that's true, well, so far I just showed you how to check that the equations of motion hold true. But we also have to ensure that what we think is the solution conserves the canonical commutation relations. Well, let's check that. It actually turns out that because the A in operators obey the right commutation relations, namely that they commute into a 1, also the A out operators will obey that commutation relation. So more generally, the proposition is that if we find A in operators that obey the right commutation relations, then our solution A of t obeys the canonical commutation relations automatically for all times. It's not difficult to see. Let's assume that we have A in operators that obey the correct commutation relations. Then what are the commutation relations between A of t and A dagger of t for arbitrary t? Well, I'm writing here what A of t is, the fully general solution. It's given by A in times this plus, and then there's this integral here. And on the other side of the commutator, there's again A in times that, and again this integral there. The only difference is that here we have a minus, and here we have a plus. This is the complex the Hermitian conjugate of that, because here we have A and here we have A dagger. But these extra terms are just proportional to the identity operator, therefore commutative. And here too. And what that means is that the commutator here reduces to the commutator between A in times the exponential and A in dagger times the exponential. And it just gives us the commutator between A in and A dagger times the product of those two exponentials, but they have opposite signs because one comes from A and one comes from A dagger, so these go away, and that is just one, and therefore we have conservation of the commutation relation. Later we will see that this is not an accident, but that the equations of motion already enforce the conservation of the commutation relations. It would have been conceivable that you solve the equations of motion and you find that there are many different solutions, some of which conserve the commutation relations and some of which don't, in which case you would have to choose those that conserve the commutation relations. But as we will later see, our commutation relations are such that we don't have to worry about this. They're automatically conserving the canonical commutation relations. Ultimately, because the equations of motion will be generated, the dynamics will be generated by a Hamiltonian, and therefore the time evolution will be unitary, and unitary time evolutions preserve any kind of commutation relations. But it'll be non-trivial to show that this is still true when the notion of time becomes non-trivial. See, in cosmology, what is a moment in time is ambiguous, because in space-time, you can foliate space-time into space-like hypersurfaces of equal time in many different ways. And then it becomes non-trivial to show that the canonical commutation relations are conserved. It will do it. Okay, now let's focus on the description of the initial period before the force acted, and then the description of the later period after the force acted. Both of them will be very similar because no force is acting, so they're just free theories, unperturbed harmonic oscillators. So in the initial period, t equal to zero, before the force acted, the dynamical variables are very simple. A of t is simply this. There is no other term which contains the j because j hasn't started yet. So therefore, we can immediately write down what the q of t and what the q hat of t and the p hat of t is. Because remember that this, the a of t is a linear combination of q and p. We can invert that relationship and then we get q hat and p hat in terms of a and a dagger. So from this, we automatically get that q hat of t is this and p hat of t is that. Remember, q hat is basically the Hermitian part of A, and p hat is the anti-Hermitian part of A. The Hamiltonian takes this form. The extra term with the force is not yet there. The force hasn't started acting yet. A of t is this at early times. Therefore, we can write the Hamiltonian in terms of A and A dagger and this exponential factor. So the Hamiltonian takes this form. But you see, this time dependence and that time dependence cancel each other away. Therefore, the Hamiltonian is actually time independent before the force starts acting. That cannot be said about the position and momentum operator. See, these guys still have time dependence. So time they are depending on time as they should, because you could be describing a harmonic oscillator that's excited. And of course, the position and the momentum would be time dependent. But the energy of a harmonic oscillator, be it excited or not excited, the energy of a free harmonic oscillator without a driving force is always conserved. That's what we see here. So no matter how complicated the dynamics is of the free harmonic oscillator before the force kicks in, the energy is conserved, and not only is the energy expectation value conserved, every matrix element of the Hamiltonian is conserved. Because as an operator, it is just constant. There's no time dependence in this anymore. Now, what is the Hilbert space of states at early times? So we need to find a basis, so that we then conveniently can write down any state that we may want to work with as a linear combination of these basis vectors. In principle, we could choose the position eigenbasis or the momentum eigenbasis, as we often do. But not here, because as we just saw, the position momentum operators are time dependent. It would be really inconvenient to work with their eigenvectors, because the eigenvectors are time dependent too. So then we would have a time dependent basis to work with. That's generally not a good idea. But we saw that the Hamiltonian is constant in time before the force kicks in. And since it is constant in time, also its eigenvectors are going to be a constant in time. So therefore, they're going to provide a convenient basis, one that doesn't change. So what then is the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian at early times, before the force kicks in? Well, the Hamiltonian before the force kicks in, the Hamiltonian at times that are smaller than zero, t smaller than zero, the Hamiltonian is simply this constant operator here, with the a in operators obeying these canonical commutation relations. So now let's assume that there exists a vector. Let's pretend for a moment, we don't know anything about the harmonic oscillators. Let's assume that there exists a vector that we will denote by zero in, which is annihilated by the a in operator. So a in annihilates that vector. So this is not the zero length vector in the Hilbert space. That is, right? So this is a normalizable vector in the Hilbert space. And then when A acts on it, you get the zero length vector in the Hilbert space. So assuming that such a vector exists, what property will it have? What properties will it have? Well, it will have the property that our early Hamiltonian, when applied to that zero in vector, gives us omega times a degree in, a in plus 1/2 acting on that zero in vector. And the a acts on that zero in vector by annihilating it. So we just get a 1/2 times that. So we get that the zero in vector is an eigenvector to our Hamiltonian with eigenvalue 1/2 omega. Remember, we are choosing units now where h bar is 1. So we recognize that we recognize this vector, 0 in, as the ground state vector of the harmonic oscillators. It's, of course, the lowest energy eigenvector of the Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator. And so, indeed, it does exist. Now, let's look at another vector. Let's look at the vector that's obtained by applying a dagger in onto the 0 in vector. And that vector we will call 1 in. Just like later on, we will have a vector a million in or 380 in. So the vector 1 in is obtained by applying a dagger in once on 0 in. What does the Hamiltonian do to it? If we take the Hamiltonian at early times, t smaller 0, and apply it to the vector 1 in, this one, then we obtain here the Hamiltonian acting on the a dagger in, applied to the state 0 in. I'm only going to do this in such tedious detail today, and then I will assume that you've definitely all seen this. I'm hoping, of course, that you've all seen that in a quantum mechanics class before. If we do this, what's the next step? Well, we have 1/2 times a dagger in 0. That's fine, and we can't simplify that further, but we recognize that a dagger in acting on 0 in is just our vector 1 in. So that term doesn't pose any problem. But we have here a dagger. Well, we can use the canonical commutation relations on that. So we have a dagger. Now a dagger, by the canonical commutation relations, is a dagger a plus 1. So what we have is that this term gets carried forward, becomes that one. I mean, this omega, that 1/2, this a dagger, that's just this. And then that term, omega times a dagger, becomes omega a dagger and this, using the canonical commutation relations. The benefit is that that term goes away, because the a acts now on 0 in, but a in on 0 in annihilates the state. So we're just left with omega times 1 plus omega 1/2, multiplying a dagger in. So we get omega times 3/2 a dagger in, omega times 3/2 1 in. So therefore, this state is an eigenstate to the Hamiltonian with eigenvalues 3/2 omega. So it's the first excited state of the harmonic oscillator. Is this vector normalized? Well, yes. Easy to calculate. 1 in, 1 in, and then we just write out what it is. A dagger in to the right, and then the Hermitian conjugate has an A in to the left. And we use the canonical commutation relations to turn those around. A dagger becomes A dagger A plus 1. The A in annihilates the 0 in. We're just left with 1. And since we assume this to be a normalized state, we get a 1. With very similar methods, you can prove this proposition, and I strongly recommend that if you haven't done it yet, do it. Prove this, namely the proposition is that the set of vectors n in, n running from 0 to infinity, defined by this formula, n in is 1 over square root of n factorial times a dagger in to the power n, acting on 0 in. The proposition is that these states are also normal. And in fact, they form a basis of the Hilbert space. So it's relatively straightforward to verify that these are orthonormal.
Question?
Yep.
So we show that they are orthogonal and we show that they are normalized, but how do we say that they are like constituting a basis just by looking at
Yeah, you have, no, that would be difficult to prove. But fortunately, the so-called spectral theorem has been proven before, and we don't have to reprove that. So you can just appeal to that. The spectral theorem says that if you have a normal operator, then its eigenstates form, or its eigenvectors form bases of the Hilbert space. This is slightly subtle if the spectrum is continuous, because then the eigenvectors wouldn't be normalizable. But it's totally straightforward if all of the eigenvalues are discrete, and the if the spectrum is discrete and the eigenvectors are normalizable. A normal vector is a vector that commutes with itself. And examples are the self-adjoint operators, so they have a spectral theorem. Self-adjoint operators, eigenbases, eigenvectors form an orthonormal basis, in fact, the Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space. The same is true for unitary operators. They too commute with their Hermitian conjugate, right? I mean, self-adjoint operators, of course, commute with the Hermitian conjugate because they are their Hermitian conjugates. Every operator commutes with itself. Unitaries also commute with their Hermitian conjugate because they are their inverses, and any operator commutes with its inverse. So, but there are also operators that are neither, but they could be still be normal operators. Do you know any operators that are not normal? That would be operators whose eigenvectors, even if they're normalizable, are not orthonormal and may not span the Hilbert space. Yeah? That's right. The A operator is not normal. It doesn't commute with its Hermitian conjugate, A dagger. In fact, the commutator is 1. Right? Yeah, that's right. And yet, we will be interested in the eigenvectors. As we will see, find out today, the eigenvectors of A are super important. They're so-called coherent states. And they're not orthogonal. Now we know why. Yes?
To prove that this is a basis, then, using the spectral theorem, you still have to show that these are all of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian.
That's right. That's right. So in principle, what you have to show is that the Hamiltonian is a self-adjoint operator, and that you've collected all of its eigenvectors. And then you know that you have a Hilbert basis of the space.
Is there an easy way to do that?
In principle, this can be hard, but I think for the harmonic oscillator, it's not difficult. Ericsson? Okay. Okay, so one thing is to show that these vectors are also normal. So you just write down n in as a ket and as a Bragg vector, and then you have lots of a and a daggers, have to commute them to each other, and then you work out what the inner product is, and you can verify that this way. But you can also check that these vectors are actually eigenvectors of the early Hamiltonian, and the eigenvalues en are given by omega times n plus 1/2. Again, if you haven't done this calculation before, I strongly recommend you do that so that you get a feel for the relationship between the Hamiltonians and the A dagger operators. I'm calling these A and A dagger operators instead of creation and annihilation operators or raising and lowering operators because, as we will see later on today, they don't always do that. They don't always create or annihilate. They don't always raise or lower. So it's a misleading terminology, as you will see. Okay, so a proposition that, as I said, we are not proving here is that this is a complete eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian. The word complete is redundant, because if it's a basis, it's going to be complete. Okay, so let's quickly summarize what we found regarding choosing a basis at early time. We found that the Hamiltonian at early times is constant. So at early times, we can drop the t here. And therefore, it has, because it's a constant operator, it has always the same eigenbasis at early times, before the force kicks in. And that eigenbasis we just calculated, these are these vectors n in, obtained by applying multiple times the a dagger in operator on the zero in vector. Now we can expand every arbitrary vector in the Hilbert space, let's call it gamma, in this basis. So every vector in the Hilbert space is some linear combination, some series, with coefficients gamma n of these vectors n in. And we can do this expansion not only at early times, we can do it anytime. Because that's just math, it has nothing to do with the physics. We just found a basis. We have a basis of the Hilbert space, and any vector that we may be interested in at any point in time, we can expand in that basis. Just as a practical mathematical matter. So these vectors, n in, always form a Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space, not only at early times. At early times, they happen to be the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian, but at late times, they may not be. And yet, I mean, they're just the Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space, and so they keep that property, of course, at all times. So, for example, the state of our quantum system, let's call it gamma, could be the 5-in state. So the fifth excited state of our harmonic oscillator at early times. Then, that's fixing the initial conditions. And remember, the dynamics is now completely in the operators. The system is going to remain being described by that Hilbert space vector even as the evolution becomes non-trivial. Even as the force kicks in. That's the vector that we describe, that we use to describe the state of the system. All of the dynamics is encoded in the time evolution of the operators, such as q hat, p hat, and a hat. So the system always stays in that state, well, until we perform a measurement. But if a force is acting, the Hamiltonian changes, and then this vector generally ceases to be the fifth eigenvector of the Hamiltonian, because the Hamiltonian has changed. It's still the same vector in the Hilbert space, but the Hamiltonian has become a different operator. And so generally, with non-trivial time dependence, that vector loses its interpretation as the fifth eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. It's still 5-in, it's still the fifth, the fifth excited state of the in-Hamiltonian, of the early Hamiltonian, but at later times, it's not going to be the fifth excited state of the actual Hamiltonian that's time dependent. Now let us look at the period t larger than capital T. So after the force acted. So once the driving force started to act, h of t starts to change. Now after the force finished, t larger than capital T, the Hamiltonian is taking again a simpler form. The Hamiltonian is omega times a dagger of t, a of t, plus 1/2, minus the force term, but at late times, the force term is again absent, right? J of t is 0 for t larger capital T. The Hamiltonian takes this form. And from our considerations before, we know that a of t at late times becomes a out times e to the power minus I omega t. And a dagger of t is the Hermitian conjugate of that, so it's this. So therefore, the Hamiltonian at late times, after the force finished acting, the Hamiltonian becomes omega times a out plus 1/2, and again, no time dependence. So the energy is again conserved. It doesn't mean that the Hamiltonian, that the harmonic oscillator is somehow not doing much. No, it could be that the force was acting like hell and the harmonic oscillator is, you know, very much excited. It's just that the Hamiltonian is constant. Completely constant. The energy cannot change for the harmonic oscillator that's undriven. But of course, the q hat of t and the p hat of t will reflect what the force has done. And will, for example, the expectation values of q hat and p hat, they could be varying widely. as a consequence of the force having acted. So we don't expect that Q hat and P hat are time independent after the force has ceased acting. Okay, but for our purposes now, let us look at the Hilbert space again. You see, just this is a simulation, this is a situation very similar to what we had before the force acted. We have a constant Hamiltonian. Therefore, it makes sense to look for its eigenbasis. And because if it was time dependent, its eigenvectors would be time dependent. But it's constant in time, so its eigenvectors are constant in time, so it's a convenient basis to work with. So we can work very similarly to how we did it before, and we can calculate a basis of the Hilbert space, but now using A out to construct that basis. And we start now with a normalized vector 0 out, which is annihilated by the vector, by the operator A out.
Sure.
Yep.
Can we always find such an eigenvector?
Yes. Yes, it's not trivial to show these things, but basically, if you write this down in terms of differential equations, if you write it down, for example, for harmonic oscillator for in the position representation, then this equation becomes an explicit differential equation. Namely, you have the A out operator, which is, if you remember, A out is a constant times the position operator, and then a constant times the momentum operator. And they can be represented as multiplication and differentiation operators. And then you can describe this vector that is as yet unknown, even its existence we don't know, but you can write it as a function of x, just in its position representation. And then the question of whether or not such a state exists boils down to the question of whether or not a certain differential equation has a solution, right? So the equation, the differential equation that consists of a multiplication and a differentiation operator acting on a wave function in x. And so you can then work that out explicitly. And you find that, yes, it has a solution. And yeah. Okay. So now let's compare the situation before the force acted to the situation after the force acted. Things are relatively simple before, relatively simple after, but what changed? So we will look at four different things here. We will look at motion. What does the expectation value of the position as a function of time know about the past action of the force? Once we look at that, we can ask, well, what's the phenomenon of resonance? How does resonance come up in this? So after all, we expect that if the driving force had mostly frequencies that matched or were similar to the natural frequency of the harmonic oscillator omega, then we expect that there's a lot of motion after the force acted. Otherwise, if the driving force was very far removed in frequency from the natural frequency of the harmonic oscillator, we expect that there's not much motion afterwards, assuming that the harmonic oscillator started in, let's say, the ground state. Also, we can ask how much energy did the action of the force pump into the harmonic oscillator, or indeed take out of it? And what happened with the energy eigenstates? If we started out with, let's say, the harmonic oscillator being in the ground state, what are the chances that we will later find it, after the force finished acting, in an excited state? This will boil down to the question whether particles have been created once we deal with quantum field theory. Because these harmonic oscillators are going to be mode oscillators, and exciting them means describing the creation of particles. Okay, so in order to perform this comparison, we make a choice for how the system starts out. And the choice is that our harmonic oscillator starts in the ground state. And then from that, we will see quite easily how we can work with more complicated initial states. So let's say the harmonic oscillator started out in its ground state. And then a force acted from the time zero to the time capital T. And then we want to know, after the force has finished acting, what happens to the motion? How much is the harmonic oscillator oscillating? Q bar is the expectation value of the position. Then, do we see the phenomenon of resonance? What about the energy expectation? How much energy has been put into the system or taken out of it? Well, you can't take energy out of it because it was in its ground state, low energy state. But how much has been put into it, and how much excitation did the system experience? So point A was motion. Okay, so what is the position expectation value at late times, after capital T, when the force has stopped acting? Well, the state of our system is gamma, which is the zero in state. And here's the operator whose expectation value we want to know. There we go. That's how we calculate that. So gamma is zero in, and q hat of t is this. Right? It's just true for all times. Q hat is this because it's for all times. The A was the linear combination of the Q and the P, and so similarly the Q is the linear combination of the A net degas, the Hermitian part. That's the general formula, if you remember. So now we need to evaluate this. Now for early times, t smaller or equal to zero, we have that A of t is simply A in times e to the power minus I omega t, and A dagger becomes that. And we have that this operator acting on zero in annihilates it. And the A dagger in acting on the left annihilates that one. Or you can also view it this way, that you act this with this operator here on the right, and you get the one in operator, which is orthogonal to the zero in operator. So the position expectation value is zero. What this is saying is that if the harmonic oscillator is in the ground state, then the position expectation value is zero. No wonder we know how it looks like. It's a Gaussian. It's symmetric, left-right symmetric, so the position expectation value is clearly zero, as it should be. Now, for times larger than capital T, what's the position expectation value now as a function of time? Again, the state is still gamma because we are in the Heisenberg picture, hasn't changed. The operator whose expectation value we want to know is q hat, so this is the calculation of the expectation value. Q hat is, as always, this linear combination. But at late times, remember, we established that a of t is a out of t times this phase, and the a dagger is the Hermitian conjugate of that. And you see, now it's no longer so simple to evaluate, because we don't know a priori how A out acts on zero in. We only know that A out annihilates zero out, and A in annihilates zero in. But here we have A out acting on zero in. In order to evaluate that, we express A out as A in plus J naught. Remember? That's the relationship between A out and A in. A out is A in plus J naught, J naught being that integral of the driving force there, from zero to capital T. And now we see that we have an A in acting on zero in, so that goes away. Similarly, the A dagger in acting on a zero in to the left goes away. And we are left with just those two terms, J naught and J naught star. So as promised, the J naught contains the information about what cumulatively the force has done to the harmonic oscillator once everything is said and done, once the force has stopped acting. So what we obtain is that the position expectation value is this function of time. It's just a number valued function here. It is actually real, because that is the complex conjugate of that, as it should be. Position expectation values should be real. And so we can also rewrite this in this way as an integral over the sine of t minus t prime omega over omega times j of t, using how j naught was defined. J naught was defined as an integral over certain phases and the driving force. And because here we are taking this linear combination, we can write J naught as an integral over some real components. I leave it to you as an exercise to check that expression. So what we obtain is that the position expectation value as a function of time behaves like this. The only time dependence is here in this t, because that t prime is being integrated over, right? So we integrated that t prime, and the only time dependence is in t. And the t is multiplied with omega, which means that the whole thing has a sinusoidal behavior with frequency omega, as one might expect. The harmonic oscillator, after the force is finished acting, is going to oscillate harmonically, sinusoidally, with frequency omega. It can't do anything else. A harmonic oscillator of frequency omega, if left alone, can only oscillate at frequency omega. But the amplitude and phase are determined by this here. And now we can also address the phenomenon of resonance. So the amplitude and phase of the oscillation is determined by this expression here. That's q bar of t. And therefore by j naught. But what was j naught? J naught, here's the reminder, was defined in this way. It's I over square root of 2 omega, integral from 0 to t, and then you have the driving force multiplied with e to the power I omega t prime. And I think we had that up before, where I already mentioned that this is describing the phenomenon of resonance. Because if the driving force matches, let's say it has a completely different frequency from the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, omega. Let's say this is a driving force of a completely different frequency. In this case, if that is a plane wave of a certain, let's say, very, very high frequency, then this is multiplying that plane wave of a lower frequency. They are orthogonal to each other if you integrate over the entire real line. You would have no resonance, and the driving force, a driving force that doesn't match the frequency here, should not excite our harmonic oscillator. Except that the driving force acts for a finite amount of time. Therefore, this is not the typical integral that would give you the inner product between two plane waves. That would have to run over the entire real line. No, it just runs over a finite time interval. Therefore, we don't have perfect orthogonality. Even if this is a plane wave whose frequency doesn't match that plane wave, generally, because the interval is of finite size, we still have that this integral can have a finite value, which means that the driving force can produce a finite J naught and therefore a lingering effect after the force has acted. So a force that doesn't act at the resonance frequency, but acts temporarily, can still excite the harmonic oscillator to some extent. The closer it is in frequency to this, the stronger is the contribution. If it is in fact the exact same plane wave as that, same frequency, but complex conjugated here, then that is just a one, and we have the integral here, and then it's just the contribution here is just a constant, just one, and it grows with time t. This is the phenomenon that we discussed earlier, last lecture, namely that when you have resonance, the amplitude of the oscillation grows linearly in time. Right? If this matches that, so that this is just a constant, then this integral grows linearly with capital T, with the duration of the time that the force acts. Therefore, J naught increases linearly with time. The longer you let the force act, the larger J naught becomes, and therefore, the larger the larger is the amplitude of Q bar of T, because the amplitude of Q bar of T is proportional to the modulus of J naught. Now, why is it that we have that the driving force can excite the harmonic oscillator even when it is off resonance. We said that mathematically it is because we are just integrating over a finite amount of time. Therefore, we don't have perfect orthogonality of plane waves. Plane waves are orthogonal at different frequencies if you integrate over the entire real line, but not if you integrate over just a finite interval. Then the inner product between the two is like a sinc function, or sinc of, I mean, sine of omega minus omega prime over omega minus omega prime. Now, the fact that you can have resonance effects, even when you are at off-resonant frequency of a finite time interval, is an expression of the time, energy, and certainty principle. Right? So the longer you make the time interval, the more orthogonal do plane waves become. The shorter you make it, the more they have an overlap. Okay, energy expectation values. Comparison of energy expectation before and after the force acts. So at early times, we have that the Hamiltonian expectation value, given by this expression, at early times takes this particular form. The state of our system is 0 in. State of our system is 0 in. And then the Hamiltonian at early times takes this simple form. The A in term annihilates that, and we're just left with 1/2. Yeah, the ground state of the harmonic oscillator has energy h bar omega 1/2. No surprise here. Now, for large times, after the force has stopped acting, we have that the energy expectation value is calculated this way, where we have that the Hamiltonian is expressed in terms of the A out operator. Again, we have this phenomenon that A out is acting on 0 in. In order to work out what it does, we have to express A out in terms of A in, which we can do. Remember, A out is A in plus J naught. And A out dagger is A in dagger plus J naught star. Then the A in annihilates that vector, the A in dagger annihilates that vector, and we're just left with this expression here. So the energy expectation value is actually given by omega times, and then it's J naught star plus 1/2, expectation value of that. But there's no operator in here, I mean, it's just the identity operator. So therefore, it is just omega times 1/2 plus modulus of J naught squared. So again, the modulus of J naught tells us how much the driving force affected the harmonic oscillator. The J naught amplitude told us what the size of the amplitude is of the Q hat, of the P hat. And now we see that the modulus square of J naught also tells us how much energy has been pumped into the harmonic oscillator. That's the energy that it had before, and that's the energy that it has after the force has acted. And again, resonance phenomenon. If the driving force is more or less resonant with the omega of the harmonic oscillator, then our J naught is large, and therefore a lot of energy gets put into the harmonic oscillator. So the amplitude grows linearly, but the energy grows quadratically in time when we have resonance. Right. Now, in quantum field theory, we can consider, for example, the case where we have the mode oscillators of the electromagnetic field. And the driving force for these mode oscillators, classical driving force for these mode oscillators, could be, for example, electrical currents, charges and currents. In principle, we should, of course, quantize both the electromagnetic field and the electrons that carry the charges around. But it is often a good approximation to treat one of the two as a classical. For example, we could consider the quantum field of electromagnetism, We quantize the photons. The photons are excitations of the mode oscillators of the electromagnetic field. And we therefore decompose the electromagnetic field into its Fourier components, into its modes. And we will find that currents and charges of electrons, for example, can excite those harmonic oscillators of the electromagnetic field. So it's a very similar situation to what we did here. The J come from currents of electrons, and the harmonic oscillators are the mode oscillators of the electromagnetic field, with the particles with excitations being photons. I will later come back to a very important point relating to that. I hope I don't forget. So what we've seen here in particular is that the out ground state, the zero out, is not equal to the zero in. Energy is different, the expectation values of position momenta are different, and so on. So the ground state zero out of the late Hamiltonian has an eigenvalue omega half. So A out on the zero out vector is zero. And the A out vector applied to the state of our system, which was the zero in vector. Sorry, I think I misspoke. I mean gamma is the initial state of our system. When we write down what A does on the state of our system, so A out, what does it do on the state of our system? Well, A out is A in plus J naught. If we apply that to zero in, then, well, the A in annihilates that vector, and we're just left with J naught times gamma, the state of our system. So from this, we see two important things. One is that the A out operator does not annihilate our zero in vector, the state of our system. And that means that the A in is the zero in vector, the gamma, the state gamma, the state of our system, is not zero out. So the zero in vector is not equal to the zero out vector. Another thing I want to comment on is this. Remember how we said that there are normal operators that can be diagonalized, and then their eigenbasis is actually a basis. It's a Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space. And then we said that the A and A dagger operators are not normal. They don't commute with each other. And then we said, well, what about the eigenvectors? Their eigenvectors don't have to be also normal. In fact, they are not. It turns out they are not. And they don't span the Hilbert space in an orthonormal way. Now, what is sometimes said is that the A operators and the A dagger operators are raising or lowering number expectation values. And certainly we have seen that happening earlier when we applied the A dagger operator onto the zero in vector, A dagger in on zero in vector, then we got the one in vector. Applied it again, we got the two in and the three in and so on. So the A dagger is certainly raising the number expectation there in this case. And the A operator can be shown to do the opposite, reducing it by one. But keep in mind, that's only true when the A and A dagger operators act on these number eigenvectors. If you have an A dagger operator acting on an eigenvector of the number operator n, then it will turn it into the n plus 1 eigenvector. But if you apply your A dagger operator on an arbitrary state, it doesn't necessarily increase the number expectation value by 1. And similarly, if you apply the annihilation operator A on an arbitrary state, the number expectation doesn't necessarily go down by 1. And here we see a stark example of that. If you apply the A out operator on that vector gamma, you get that vector gamma back. See, with the number in front of it. But basically, you apply the A out operator on a vector you get an, you find out it's an eigenvector actually. Gamma is an eigenvector of A out. But what that means is that the A operator has not lowered the number expectation value because it hasn't actually changed the vector. Right? It gamma is an eigenvector of it. So when you apply the so-called annihilation operator onto one of its eigenvectors, well, then it's not changing any eigenvector. In fact, you can find vectors such that when you apply an annihilation operator on it, the number expectation value goes up. You can even have it go up by a billion if you want. I had a PSI student with whom we worked out these vectors explicitly. the paper will come out soon. It will be just a part of a larger project. But anyway, so the annihilation operator and creation operators raise and lower number eigenvectors number. But for all other vectors, all bets are off. They could increase or decrease the number expectation value. As we have seen here, we are not changing the number expectation value at all. Okay, so what we see here is a very important fact. We see that the A operators have eigenvectors. So what kind of an excited state is our state gamma at late times? Remember, the state of the system gamma is zero in. At late times, this is certainly not the ground state of the harmonic oscillator anymore. Because at late times, the zero out is the eigenvector. And we know they're not the same. So what kind of state is that? Well, since gamma is an eigenstate of a lowering operator, namely, as we just proved, the A out lowering operator acting on gamma is J naught gamma. this state gamma is what is called a coherent state. So an important thing, let's just pause for a sec. If you have a normal operator, such as a unitary or self-adjoint operator, then we often work with eigenbases, with eigenvectors, because these eigenvectors form a basis in the Hilbert space, and that is just very convenient. When we work with a non-normal operator, we may still be interested in the eigenvectors. For example, the A. The A have eigenvectors, and they will be very important. It turns out these eigenvectors are called coherent states, and it turns out that they have special properties. In particular, they minimize the uncertainty principle. And so the principle says that delta Q, delta P, larger equal H bar half. The coherent states have the property that the product delta Q, delta P is equal to H bar half. So these are states, the coherent states are states that, like, they sort of want to be eigenvectors, you see. A true eigenvector would have, for example, an eigenvector of Q would have delta Q equals zero. Eigenvectors of P would have delta P equals zero. The coherent states are eigenvectors of an operator that's not normal. And they have special properties. And the property that the eigenvectors of the A operator have is that they are minimizing the uncertainty relation. So in that sense, they describe states that are as classical as can be, because they are minimizing at least the product of the uncertainties. So let me remind you of that. I'm hoping that you don't hear that for the first time. So coherent states saturate the uncertainty relation. If psi is a coherent state, remember, meaning psi is an eigenvector of the A operator, then, and there are many eigenvectors of the A operator, we just found one of them. If psi is an eigenvector of an A operator, so it is called a coherent state, then delta Q delta P in that state is equal to H bar half. So these states are, in a sense, the closest to having definite values for both Q and P, because they are as close as possible to obeying that they are eigenvectors to both Q and to P. We know, of course, that there cannot be joint eigenvectors of Q and P, but these guys are at least trying. Right? They make the uncertainties as small as possible. Remember that only for eigenvectors is the uncertainty zero. right? And coherent states try to get there as close as possible. Yes?
Is that the definition of coherent state, or is that just a property of a coherent state?
No, this is the definition of coherent states. Okay. It's the eigenstates of the annihilation operator. So, and by the way, I may throw in another definition.
The definition is that it's an eigenstate, or so the fact that delta Q delta P equals H bar over 2 is not the definition of a coherent state?
No.
Okay.
No, that's right. So that's a subtlety. So the definition of a coherent state is that it's an eigenvector to the A operator. Now, to complete the picture, since you're asking, what about other states that also are at the boundary of the uncertainty principle, right, for which delta Q delta P is logic for H bar 1? Could there be other states? And there can be. And there's a name for them. They're called squeeze states. So then what is a squeeze state? Well, remember that the A operator is not some universal operator of a quantum theory. It was tailored, its definition was tailored to a harmonic oscillator. Right? The A operator that we used was a specific linear combination of Q and P such that the Hamiltonian of our harmonic oscillator with our omega, that Hamiltonian is simple. Now imagine you take another harmonic oscillator with a different frequency. Then you can also define an A operator. Let's call it A tilde operator. This one has coefficients such that the Hamiltonian for a different frequency harmonic oscillator is simple. Right? Remember that the definition of A in terms of Q and P contains omega. So if you consider different harmonic oscillators, you get different operators A, and therefore different coherent states. Every harmonic oscillator, so for every choice of omega, a choice of omega is a choice of harmonic oscillator, right? So for every choice of omega, you get a different definition of A operator, and therefore different definition of coherent state. And the coherent states of one harmonic oscillator are, from the perspective of another one, a squeeze state. Right? So the collection of, in principle, they are only coherent states. But if you work with one Hamiltonian, you have one A operator, and it has its eigenvectors, and they give you the coherent states for that harmonic oscillator. But then the coherent states of another harmonic oscillators, we would not recognize as coherent states, because they're not eigenvectors to our A operator. Right? They're eigenvectors to a linear combination of the A eigenvectors. And so the squeeze states are general. Basically, one person's squeeze state is another person's coherent state. It depends on which harmonic oscillator you're referring to.
But they still minimize the uncertainty.
Yes, yes. Because they are coherent states of another harmonic oscillator, yeah. So you've done the calculation once, you've done it for all of them, if you keep the omega flexible.
Another question.
Yeah.
So can you build an approximate basis using coherent states?
Yes, you can. Yes. And much work has gone into that. For example, Gaussians are coherent states. And you can... Yeah, I mean, for example, there has been work on replacing phase space by a space of parameters of coherent states. You see, a coherent state has... it has a complex eigenvalue, right? So, actually, it comes up now, exactly. So, each coherent state, just to anticipate it, has a complex eigenvalue because it's the eigenvector to an operator A, which is not Hermitian or anti-Hermitian. It's a complex eigenvalue. The real part of it is the expectation value of Q. The imaginary part of it is the expectation value of P. I mean, decorated with constants in front of it. And the coherent states you can use to describe a sort of fuzzy phase space, where you have an expectation value of Q, an expectation value of P that defines a point in your generalized phase space. But instead of having joint position and momentum eigenvectors, which don't exist, you have coherent states. And so you're basically using coherent states to localize as much as is possible on phase space. So coherent states can be used to generalize the phase space picture to quantum mechanics. Okay, here's a little exercise. Show that if alpha is a coherent state, so if alpha is a state which is eigenvector to the annihilation operator with eigenvalue alpha, which is a complex number in general, and we define the q hat and the p hat as we did before, then the expectation value of the position is up to this prefactor here, the real part of alpha. Alpha being the complex number that identifies our coherent state. And what is the momentum expectation value in a coherent state? If the system is in a coherent state, the momentum expectation value is up to a prefactor given by the imaginary part of the coherent state coefficient. And while we're at it, prove that delta q, delta p is equal to 1/2. All you have to do is calculate the expectation value of q, expectation value of p, expectation value of q squared, expectation value of p squared, and then you can easily calculate what the delta q and the delta p is, and it all pops out pretty straightforwardly. You don't need any unusual tricks for this. Also, here I just wrote up what I said earlier, namely that since the annihilation operator maps alpha into alpha, an eigenvector of alpha, the operator A does not reduce the excitation or particle number of alpha. Right? When we are in a coherent state, then the annihilation operator does not reduce the number expectation value. You can calculate the number expectation value. You can calculate A dagger A for a coherent state, but it will not change when you apply A to the state.
Mm-hmm. So is squeeze state just coherent state in our basis?
Basis is not the right word for it in a different set of variables. You see, the A operator has in its definition omega. Or let's put it this way, you can express the Q hat and the P hat in terms of A and A dagger, but there's a dependence on omega in there. And similarly, if you express A in terms of Q and P, there's a dependence on omega in there. So for two different harmonic oscillators, you get two different A operators. Two different frequencies, you get two different A operators. And each A operator has its coherent states. And the coherent states of one harmonic oscillator are the squeeze states of the other. Right, and that's the second remark down here. If the omega up here is chosen to be not the frequency of the harmonic oscillator of the Hamiltonian, then alpha is called a squeeze state. So one harmonic oscillator's coherent state is another harmonic oscillator's squeeze state. Okay, now what is the significance of... first, before we ask for the significance, let me just highlight what we have seen here. We have seen a super important phenomenon which permeates all of physics. The phenomenon is that when a quantum system, a harmonic oscillator, starts in its ground state, and that could be an ordinary first quantized harmonic oscillator or a harmonic oscillator of a mode of a field, if it starts out in its ground state, and then we apply a driving force to it, which may be very complicated, but at some point a driving force comes to an end, and then we can ask, what's the state of the system? Well, it depends what the driving force did, but we know one thing about it. We know that it's going to be a coherent state, right? Because we know the gamma is a coherent state. The gamma, the initial state of our system, is an eigenstate of A out. So we know that if you take a quantum harmonic oscillator in a ground state and then you shake it whichever way you want, you can only ever achieve that it ends up in a coherent state. It's going to be in one of the eigenstates of the A operator. It's amazing, because you could kick the harmonic oscillator or drive it slowly, you know, whatever you want to do, it'll end up in a coherent state. So coherent states are super important. Also because coherent states are almost classical. You know, they minimize delta Q times delta P, which means that if you have a quantum harmonic oscillator and all you can do with it is drive it externally in the way we have described here with a term with a J of T, you cannot make it behave very quantumly. Because what would it mean that you have a state for a harmonic oscillator that's very quantum? It would mean that it's a state where delta Q is, for example, large and delta P is super large. Everything is super coherent and, you know, it's super ambiguous quantumly, right? There's no way you can do that by just driving it this way. There's no way. If you just have a classical driving force and you act with it whichever way you want, it ends up in a coherent state. Now, that is super important because, just a wall of text here. Let me explain what the crucial implication of this is. Oh, yeah, lots of words. It's good to have it in a note that you can later look it up. But let me just tell you now in words what's going on. Remember, in quantum mechanics, when you were first taught quantum mechanics, you were presented with a Schrödinger equation. Usually, it just falls from the sky somehow, and then you have the Schrödinger equation. And the rule is that the Hamiltonian in the Schrödinger equation starts out with p squared divided by 2m. Plus, and then you can add the potential V of x. And you can add also magnetic field B of x times momenta or whatever you want. And the general rule is you get to choose what you put there as your electric field, and you get to choose what you put there for your magnetic field. For example, I don't know, hydrogen atom, a molecule, or you just have some radio waves come in and they shake your electron or whatnot. You're free to do so. And you're being told that the Schrödinger equation evolves your system unitarily until one of two things happen. Either you perform a measurement on it, or your system starts interacting with the environment, which is very similar to performing a measurement. But until then, it's supposed to evolve unitarily. All of what I just said is wrong, in principle. It's just true to a very high approximation that you were not told about. But in fact, what's going on is this. If you have an electron described by a Schrödinger equation, and you put there the electric field and the magnetic field by hand as a number-valued function, V of x, a number-valued function, then you're cheating. It's not true. The electric field is a quantum system. The magnetic field is a quantum system. The electromagnetic field is a quantum system. When you pretend that you can write there just the electric field and the magnetic field, you're overlooking that really what's going on is the interaction between two quantum systems. There's the electron, a quantum system, and there's the electromagnetic field, a quantum system. The electromagnetic field consists of all of its mode oscillators, each of which is quantized. And so, how come? How come that we're allowed to do this? How come that we're allowed to replace the quantum system of the electromagnetic field simply by writing down classical electric field, the classical magnetic field in the Schrödinger equation? See, fundamentally, the electron cannot evolve unitarily when it is exposed to an electromagnetic field, because it is not just exposed to an electromagnetic field. It has an interaction Hamiltonian with the electromagnetic field. The total quantum system consists of the quantum system of the electron, the quantum system of the electromagnetic field. Each one of them contributes its own Hamiltonian, plus there's going to be an interaction Hamiltonian. If there wasn't an interaction Hamiltonian, the electron would be neutral. But it isn't. It's charged. It sees the electric and magnetic field. So there is an interaction Hamiltonian. But that means that this total system, this bipartite system of the electron on one side and the electromagnetic field on the other side, these two quantum systems become entangled over time because of the interaction Hamiltonian. In general, when you have two quantum systems, they could be the electron and the electromagnetic field, but just generally two quantum systems, A and B, and let's say they start out in pure states, phi and psi, And then we have a time evolution happening in which they interact with each other. Then what's the description of this? Well, the Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian is going to be the Hamiltonian of the system A, tensor 1, plus 1 tensor, the Hamiltonian of system B, plus an interaction Hamiltonian, which we may write in the form A hat tensor B hat. Some operators. This is an operator of the first system, an operator of the second system. Okay? So then we have to apply the time evolution operator on this, the tensor product of these two states. So we have e to the power of minus I, well, let's put a t here, t, and then we have this entire Hamiltonian here. So we have h hat a tensor 1 plus 1 tensor h hat b plus a tensor b. And that is applied to phi tensor psi. And this is then our state omega of t. This is the state of the system in total. Now, when we expand this, this is a power series, then the first term is just the identity. The second term is just this. And then the third term is this thing squared and so on. Now, the identity is not going to do much, but the second term is this stuff acting on that. And you see, if there was only this and that, then we would not get an entangled state. But because of this, we do get an entangled state. You see, as long as we have, as long as that was absent, if there was no interaction, then this would just be on its own a unitary. I mean, then this whole thing is just a product of two unitaries. One acting on one factor and the other unitary acting on the other factor. So the whole thing is just separately the evolution of this state and separately the evolution of that state. So the whole thing remains unentangled because the omega of t would simply be phi of t tensor psi of t, not entangled. But that term screws this up. So generally, what we would have is like a Hamiltonian for the electron, Hamiltonian for the electromagnetic field, plus the interaction Hamiltonian. Therefore, in general, we should expect that there's going to be entanglement created. And then, I hope you know that, if you then focus on one system only, so you trace over the other system, and you find that the one system that you're still considering evolves non-unitarily. It decoheres. So why then was it legal that in quantum mechanics, in Schrödinger quantum mechanics, we write electric fields and magnetic fields as number-valued fields into the Hamiltonian? How is that kosher? It shouldn't be okay, right? Now, the reason is that the electromagnetic field, when it starts out in the vacuum state, in the ground state, consists of harmonic oscillators, mode oscillators, that each are in their ground state. And then, if you create an electromagnetic field, for example, by putting in wires and charges and so on, that can be described classically, then these will act as classical driving forces on your harmonic oscillators of the electromagnetic field. And what will they do? They will turn the electromagnetic field into a coherent state. I mean, it starts out in the ground state and will end up in a coherent state. No matter what kind of antenna you use, no matter what you put on the antenna, it's classical charges and currents, to a very good approximation, which can only excite the electromagnetic field into a coherent state. But for a coherent state, we have that the uncertainty principle is minimized, which means that the electric field and the magnetic field have as small fluctuations as possible. So the delta E fluctuations, the delta B fluctuations are very small compared to the expectation values. And that means that we have almost eigenstates. The electromagnetic field generally, if excited through classical charges and currents, the electromagnetic field generally is in a coherent state, and therefore in a state that minimizes the uncertainty principle, and therefore almost in eigenstate of the electric field operators and the magnetic field operators. That's why the electric and magnetic field generally appears to us to be classical. Because it's full of coherent states. And the math of it is this. If you have a coherent state, then we know delta Q is small, delta P is small. So what we have is that Q hat acting on a coherent state will be approximately the expectation value of Q hat times the coherent state. Not perfect, but approximately. And what that means is that when you have an interaction Hamiltonian between electrons on one side and the electromagnetic field on the other side, the electromagnetic field can be, the field operator, B, can be approximated by some expectation value of it times the identity operator, right? Because the position operator for coherent state will produce approximately the position expectation value times the coherent state. And so similarly for the electromagnetic field, the electromagnetic field has the field operator E hat and the field operator B hat. They act in principle as operators on coherent states. But with a good approximation, they will act as a multiple of the identity. That makes all the difference now for the coherence, because if this operator is replaced by some number, expectation value of B times the identity operator, okay, if we replace this operator by that, which we can do if that state is a coherent state, if we can do that, then this thing is of the form A tilde head, tensor 1. I've just absorbed that number in that operator. And therefore, it's of the same form as this one. And therefore, we have that the total unitary is the tensor product of two unitaries, and it's no longer entangling. So what we see here is that the fact that quantum harmonic oscillators, when classically driven, end up in coherent states, explains why electromagnetic fields look classical to us, and why, in the Schrödinger equation, it is approximately legal to replace electric and magnetic fields by their expectation values, except if you work with quantum light. Right? If you take quantum light where you excite individual photons, you see, these are not coherent states. If you have a three-photon state, that's not a coherent state. That's an eigenvector to A dagger A, not an eigenvector to A. Right? So it's not a coherent state. And then you have quantum light. If you do quantum optics, then with that light, it's not legal, it's not okay to put in the Schrödinger equation simply the electric field or magnetic field expectation values. It would be completely wrong. So the fascination with quantum optics is that the usual way we work with Schrödinger equation is wrong. Then it really bites that, you know, that we made an approximation there that we usually don't even worry about. Yep.
So why is it safer to assume that the charges, the antennas and so forth are classical than to just assume in the first place that the electric field is?
Well, it's a chicken and egg thing, right? So basically, but it turns out that, I mean, it's just usually a very good approximation to do that. Because when do you have situations where, for example, the position of a current or the position of a charge is uncertain in a noticeable way quantumly? And usually we know where the currents are flowing. And so the usual way that we produce electromagnetic radiation always has that property. Of course, in reality, you know, the most interesting situation is when it's not the case. So that gives you an idea of where quantum optics starts. It starts where you don't have coherent states for the electromagnetic field. I mean, it can still be useful, but yeah. All right, that's as far as we get today. All of what I just said here on a board and so on, that's also in the lecture notes. And that's the last slide. Yep. Here it is. Exactly. All right. Okay, see you on Friday then.